Overcoming Common Problems. Body Language, What You Need to Know by David Cohen. Introduction. We speak with our mouths, but communicate with our eyes, our faces, our smiles, our hands, our arms, even with our legs and toes. Possibly the only part of our bodies we don't communicate with is our belly button, and I'm not sure if this statement is true. After all, if you decorate your belly button with a metal stud, it reveals something of your personality. Stud Girl is not likely to be a shy wallflower. No one can know whether dinosaurs used some form of scaly, non-verbal communication or body language, but body language is almost certainly very ancient. There are studies of non-verbal communication in dogs, cats, horses, and even cows. Chimps and gorillas use complex systems of non-verbal communication, and we have a lot in common with them. A famous book published in the 1960s, Desmond Morris's The Naked Ape, argued that a great deal of our behavior is very similar to that of apes. Today, body language is as important as it has ever been, perhaps even more so now that we live in a 24/7, fast-changing world, the stressed society. We meet new people all the time, and we have to make up our minds about them very quickly. Do we like them? Can they be trusted? Are they likely to attack us, or will they be happy if we suggest going out on a date? 100 years ago, people needed introductions in order to be let into someone's drawing room. Today, there are virtually no such formalities. If you have 5 minutes to decide whether the person sitting opposite might be a good colleague, the love of your life, or a total loser, you need to understand their non-verbal communication, and that is not simple, for a simple reason. Homo sapiens is the only species that can lie, deceive, and try to imagine what someone has in mind. The most advanced ape can't imagine what another ape is thinking, or whether chimp A hates his guts because he envies his chest hair. In terms of guile, spite, deception, and self-knowledge, the chimp is a chump compared to us. We, proud rulers of planet Earth, can perform marvels of duplicity, so we need help to work out what someone else is really thinking, but they may be too polite, confused, clever, or manipulative to say. As we shall see, individuals differ in how well they understand body language. People who suffer from autism and schizophrenia find body language almost impossible to grasp. According to psychologist Sergio Paradiso, 1999, of the University of Iowa, as we interact with people, we make judgments that we're not consciously aware of. If we see a coworker hunched over and we don't see his face, we may approach him cautiously because we think something might be wrong and perhaps we can help. We don't see the face, but we glean information from the body language. People with schizophrenia are not as good as extracting this kind of information to guide their social interactions. The consequence can be serious. If you don't read body language, you may upset people you have to deal with and so become even more nervous and socially awkward. But it is not a simple question of intelligence. You may be very smart academically and still fail to read the signals other people give out. You may not shine at IQ tests, but be perfectly able to sense what other people feel because you respond instinctively to their body language. Responding instinctively, or with intuition, is not a kind of magic. What we're really doing is collating, almost instantly, dozens of tiny clues we've picked up from a person's body language. The way they stand and hold themselves, the angles of the arms, the expression on their faces, where they are looking, even whether the pupils of their eyes are dilated or not. Body language does not just tell us about others, however. It can reveal how we feel and worry to ourselves. In the stressed self-society, we are apt to fret and feel neurotic. Stress makes us drink too much, use too many drugs, suffer psychosomatic ills, and be very aware of our dissatisfactions. One way in which we show stress is through our body language, our tics and antics. I rub my hands because I feel worried. I shift the way I'm sitting and clasp my knees, both actions that comfort me. I notice I am fidgeting, and I realize I am more nervous about my next meeting than I want to admit. Unconscious speaks and leaks. Case history. As Tony sits opposite his boss and the head of personnel, it is hard to tell whether he is up for promotion or about to be hauled over the coals. He looks relaxed. His boss is smiling, but there is a devious reason for that. There's a mirror behind Tony that allows his boss to see what Tony is trying to hide. Tony doesn't realize the mirror is there and thinks he is managing to hide his anxiety, but his hands are behind his back and he keeps twisting his fingers, a classic sign of nervous body language. Tony also rubs his cheek. Good, thinks his boss. He wants to sack Tony and has hacked into his emails. Foolishly, Tony has been involved in an email exchange about buying cannabis. The company does not allow use of its email for personal communication, let alone buying illegal drugs. But the boss has no right to hack into other people's emails, and he's worried Tony might sue the company. Observing Tony's body language in the mirror, he can see Tony is scared and anxious to defend himself. Over the next 15 minutes, the boss is vicious, and he enjoys seeing the impact he has. Finally, Tony closes his eyes, trying to shut the whole nightmare out. The boss wins. Tony lets himself be sacked without much fuss. If the boss had not seen and been able to understand Tony's nervous body language, he would not have had the confidence to be so aggressive. But Tony couldn't control his body language, and he paid the price. Celebrity. Much body language is unconscious, and the twitch of an eyebrow, the tilt of a head, the turn of an arm, can, and often does, say volumes more than the spoken word. Such movements are at the heart of our communication as strangers, work colleagues, friends, and lovers. So it is wise to try and understand body language better. By reading others more accurately, and by being in more control of what we project, our work, social, and love life can only be enriched. Body language has a high profile today because of our obsession with celebrity. Women's magazines carry endless stories on the latest celebrities' body language. One FBI agent has even analyzed Madonna's eyelid flutters to see if she was lying on NBC television when she denied she was pregnant. For many years, of course, Madonna was not just a successful singer, but an icon. She had the perfect body. The perfect body. The media are full of images of perfect women and men, which creates anxiety and unrealistically high self-expectations in the rest of us. 1/3 of men and 70% of women think they are too fat or too large. Body image disorders are rife, including anorexia, bulimia, and body dysmorphia, a disorder in which a person has a distorted view of his or her body or a part of the body. Yet our idea of the perfect body has changed. In 1917, for example, the physically perfect woman was about 1.6 meters, 5 foot 4 inches tall, and weighed 63 kilograms, nearly 10 stone. In the early 1940s, people with thin, bony bodies were perceived as nervous, submissive, and socially withdrawn. Marilyn Monroe, on the other hand, had the ideal female body, curvy or hourglass-shaped. By the 1980s, however, curves were yesteryear. Supermodels were rake-thin, and an ounce of fat was, as is, a Greek tragedy. Even 25 years ago, however, top models and beauty queens weighed 8% less than the average woman. Now they weigh 23% less. Only 5% of women achieve what the media currently decree is the ideal weight and size. It would help, in theory, if we had a more objective idea of how we look. If the old-fashioned mirror isn't good enough, it is possible to try 3D imaging of the body. This is called body metrics. Some very new research by Professor Philip Treleaven of University College London, 2006, claims we now know better than ever before what we look like and what we find attractive about other people. Since 1920, The average woman's breast size has increased by 4 inches, her hips by 6 inches, and her waist by 8 inches, according to Treleaven. Despite all these changes in fashion, Treleaven's research suggests that often we still read bodies in age-old ways. For example, men tend to find the fuller female more attractive, while women prefer a man with a very low percentage of body fat, whether they are thin or muscular. There are biological reasons for these preferences. Larger women may appear more fertile, or find it easier to give birth. A man with a big chest looks as if he can protect his family. What is seen as the perfect body may change, but aspects of body language do not. Body language, and how it is perceived, is embedded deep in our biological heritage, so that we are often not even aware of using the clues it provides. In this book, I hope to offer a useful introduction to the latest research on body language, and practical tips that will help to understand other people's body language and manage our own. The more we know about the art and science of body language, the better we will be at these very necessary skills. Among the themes I cover are 1. Meeting someone for the first time. 2. Dating. 3. Trying to work out how someone feels about you. 4. Trying to ascertain whether something is going wrong with your significant other. And work situations, such as 1. Being interviewed for a job. 2. Being interviewed for a promotion. 3. Everyday dealings with colleagues, which can involve conflicts that sometimes get very tense. Chapter 1 looks at the history of body language research and its controversies. Chapter 2 examines the basics of body language, and Chapter 3 considers how we make our first impressions. Chapter 4 analyzes the question of personal space, what it means, and the conscious and unconscious moves we make to protect it. Chapter 5 looks at the many small and not so small details of body language, such as what we do with our hands. Chapter 6 covers the latest research on eye contact. Chapter 7 summarizes 40 years of research into facial expressions, what we can read from other people's faces, and how we control our own facial expressions. Chapter 8 moves on to the work environment and examines body language in the office and the shop. It looks at body language in interviews, how to dissect the boss's tics and fidgets, and how to cope if you are in trouble at work. It also examines an unusual technique called paradoxical intention. Chapter 9 looks at flirting, fancying, and sex, how to tell if someone of the opposite sex is interested in you, and, just as important, how to tell if they're not. Chapter 10 examines lying, how to tell if people are lying to you, and yes, how to prevent your own body language reveal you are lying. Chapter 11 looks at body language in different cultures and suggests why Arabs may find it hard to grasp the nuances of Japanese body language. Chapter 12 sums up what I hope readers will have learned. Chapter 1. The Science of Body Language. The last few years have seen more serious analysis of body language than ever before. Psychologists like Peter Collette and Jeffrey Betty of Sheffield University, the psychologist on Big Brother, have new theories. The latest brain imaging techniques allow scientists to see what part of the brain work hard when people perform various tasks. Such imaging also makes it possible to see how body language depends on certain parts of the brain and what happens when those are damaged. Child psychologists have tracked down how children develop body language skills and what to do if they aren't developing them normally. Heaven sent. A good place to start is 1853, in the small town of Lourdes in southwest France. A peasant girl, Marie Bernard Soubirous, who came to be known as Bernadette, claimed she saw an apparition of the Virgin Mary in a grotto. Her neighbors were skeptical at first. Bernadette's family was poor and she had been in trouble with the police. But people were soon persuaded that Bernadette had true visions because of the convincing way she gestured to her apparition. Within 2 years, Lourdes was a famous shrine. Even the church, which was always very worried that such visions were inspired by the devil, accepted that the peasant girl had seen the Blessed Virgin. Today, every year, thousands of pilgrims visit Lourdes, possibly because Bernadette's body language was so compelling and inspired belief. The rest of the book deals with thoroughly unspiritual matters, like sex, power, and office politics. But don't forget the religious connection. It's no accident that people often pray on their knees, one of the most submissive of all human positions. Muslims go even further than people of some other faiths that prostrate themselves before Allah. Body language and lying. Exercise 1.1. Telling a lie. Imagine you are in a situation where you suspect someone of lying. Write down the 5 key things you look for in both their words and their body language. As this is early in the book, you may need a few clues to gestures that often accompany lying. Fidgeting with your fingers, touching your nose, fidgeting with your hair ends, looking down and to the side, saying the lie while fiddling with a handbag, gloves, or cigarette. Some people argue that men and women who are very nervous may behave just like someone who is lying, and there is a germ of truth in that. Total attention, total attraction. Carl Rogers, 1902 to 1986, a famous American therapist, built a school of theory on giving clients what he called unconditional personal regard. It meant simply that when he sat across the desk and listened to them, he let them know he was listening with total concentration. Some of his techniques were: 1. He gave clients time to talk. 2. He nodded his head to encourage them to go on. 3. He waited patiently when they paused. 4. He often leaned forward to create a more intimate feeling of rapport. Many of us are not born listeners, but there is nothing mysterious about developing the skill, just as there is nothing mysterious in understanding most aspects of your own personality. Something you need to know if you were to become an MBL, a maestro of body language. Exercise 1.2. Know yourself test. Use a scale of 1 to 5, where 5 means always true of me, 4 means quite often true of me, 3 means sometimes true of me, 2 means very occasionally true of me, and 1 means never true of me. How do you rate yourself on the following questions? 1. I worry about what people think of me. 2. I ask myself why I behave the way I do. 3. I check myself in the mirror before I go out. 4. I get nervous when someone I think of as a friend acts in a way I don't understand. 5. I worry that I am far too vain. 6. I get nervous when I go into a room and I know no one there. 7. I like to try to work out what other people are thinking. 8. There are certain things about other people's body language I always notice. 9. I think it is important to be calm, cool, and collected. 10. I wished I looked different, was better looking, like Nicole Kidman or Brad Pitt, but I don't lose sleep over it. 11. I find it hard to concentrate on listening to what other people have to say. 12. I am often anxious that I may not make a good impression. 13. I like observing other people. 14. I like observing other people when they don't realize I'm doing it. 15. It bothers me that other people may guess what I'm thinking by just looking at me. Answers. In theory, you could score 75 on this test. Questions 1 to 6, 12, and 15 assess your anxieties about the impression you make. If you are always anxious about these issues, you could score as high as 40 on these questions. The utterly unanxious will score 8. A total of 30 to 40 suggests you are very anxious about how you present your body language. A score of 20 to 30 suggests you are somewhat anxious about this. Under 20 suggests you are quite relaxed about this. Questions 7 to 11, 13 and 14 are about detachment and being curious about body language. You could score 35 on these questions. If you score between 25 and 35, you are very curious about other people's body language and quite detached. If you score 15 to 25, you are averagely curious and averagely detached. If you score under 15, you aren't really interested in other people's body language and are missing fascinating clues about how people behave. Controversy. Today, experts on body language are in the middle of a controversy. Traditionalists claim that you can divorce nonverbal behavior almost entirely from words. Perhaps the most extreme claims are made by a Californian psychologist, Professor Albert Mehrabian. He said in the 1970s that 7% of meaning is in the words that are spoken, 38% of meaning is paralinguistic, the way the words are said, 55% of meaning is in the facial expression that accompanies the words. Nonverbal cues account for 93% of the meaning we take from any interaction, according to Mehrabian, 1972. Many people accept these statistics. In theory, therefore, if I smile sweetly and sound like a cooing dove while I tell you that you are an unpleasant person, you'll not pay that much attention to the unpleasant part of the message and won't be upset. After all, 93% of my message, the smile and the cooing, is positive. I wouldn't try that approach myself. Most people do seem to mind if you call them unpleasant, so it is no surprise that Mehrabian's ideas are contradicted in the works of artists and scientists, including those of William Shakespeare, among others. The idea that your gestures matter more than your words flies in the face of the advice Hamlet delivers to the player King, the leader of the troupe of actors who came to the court of the King of Denmark. Suit the action to the word to the action, with especial observance that you o'erstep not the modesty of nature. That's still good advice for actors. Many scientists, including Big Brother psychologist Jeffrey Betty, in his Visible Language, 2004, think that psychology should catch up with Hamlet. Words and gestures go together and should be considered jointly as a communication package, not split into different bits, as Mehrabian suggests. And the result is that body language is even more revealing. Betty claims, "We are now recognizing that much of our body language is fleeting, and, rather than revealing emotions, it actually reveals what we are thinking as well." Darwin had a word for it. Philosophers in ancient Greece argued that the good and evil passions, by their continual exercise, stamp their impress on the face, and that each particular passion has its own expression. The Greek poet Homer observed how expression and appearance correlated with character. Some 2,000 years later, in 1600, Sir Francis Bacon, the Lord Chancellor of England, said, "You could learn the disposition of the mind by the lineaments of the body." This science came to be known as physiognomy, but it did not have a very good reputation, as many of those who claimed to practice it were only in it for the money. There were so many abuses that an Act of Parliament in 1743 condemned all persons pretending to have skill in physiognomy as rogues and vagabonds to be publicly whipped or sent to jail. Luckily, that law doesn't seem to be practiced now, otherwise I and many fellow authors of body language books would be in the nick. By 1872, it was safe for the eminently respectable Charles Darwin to publish The Expressions of the Emotions in Man and Animals. Darwin, the father of the theory of evolution, had noticed that apes use certain gestures over and over again. He got scientists from all over the world to send him interesting examples of such animal language, as he called it. Darwin wanted to see if there were any links between human gestures and animal gestures. He got hundreds of replies, especially descriptions of teeth-baring, laughter, and displays of triumph when apes tended not to just thump their chests, but also leap, run, and yelp. I would never suggest that today's footballers remotely resemble gorillas, but shall we say that when certain ball wizards score, they behave in ways Darwin would have recognized. The alpha ape thumps his chest after socking it to a lesser ape. The triumphant alpha male footballer, when he has socked the ball into the net, runs frantically, cartwheels, and hugs his teammates. Most footballers don't thump their chests like King Kong, but there is no mistaking the meaning of their ritual dance. It trumpets, "I am the top dog, top ape, top foot, top banana." There are some differences between the ace gorilla and the ace sharpshooter, however. For one, the gorilla is far too inhibited to get involved in a celebrity group hug. The group hug for sports teams has now even spread to cricket, once the most reserved of sports. W.G. Grace must be turning in his grave, and the centre forward is unlikely to urinate either in the goal, which he has conquered, or over his opponents, in sheer hotshot exuberance. The gorilla will not blow a kiss to the crowd. The centre forward, if he has been getting a bad press, may race at the crowd, wagging his finger manically. Gorillas do not go in for this gesture, perhaps because they don't care about bad write-ups in The Daily Ape. Exercise 1.3. Self-observation. When was the last time you felt triumphant? How did you behave? Were you happy for other people to see how energized you felt? If you wanted to hide it, what did you do to conceal your sense of triumph? Tip: beware of showing how good you feel when you have triumphed. It is apt to make people feel resentful unless they really love you and approve of your success. Most people are more ambivalent. Darwin even speculated that you can spot a selfish character just from nonverbal cues. Shyness is also, I believe, exhibited chiefly by movements about the eyes, for those are under less control of the will, owing to the force and long-continued habits, than are the other movements of the body. After Darwin, there was little academic study of body language until the 1960s, when two men turned their attention to the subject that made it both popular and academically respectable. One was the zoologist Desmond Morris, who wrote The Naked Ape, 1967, showing how much human behavior was similar to that of gorillas, baboons, and chimps. The second writer was a quirky man who taught me psychology when I was at Oxford. Michael Argyle was tall, rather awkward, and not always subtle. He used to stick a pillow under his bottom, which made him sit up far taller than us students. The taller you sat, the more superior you were, he told us as he patted the pillow. For a distinguished academic, he had some surprising insecurities, but his ideas on height were sound, as we shall see. Argyle argued that most people, when they look straight at you, are being sincere. The eyes are the windows to the soul, but not with everyone. Some people have a Machiavellian personality type. Argyle gave it that name after the famous 16th century Italian author, Niccolò Machiavelli. Machiavelli wrote the key text on how to be ruthless in politics, The Prince. Some modern politicos even admit that they still consult it, as it has timeless tips for the vital art of plotting, leaking information, and stabbing colleagues in the back. Machiavellian types, Argyle said, are so naturally devious that they can look someone straight in the eye, sound as sincere as a saint, and lie all the while. Shakespeare understood Machiavellian types. He made his villain Richard III say, "Why I can smile and murder whilst I smile, and cry content to that which gives me pause." Shakespeare knew both that gestures normally reinforce what we say as Hamnet said, and that they do not have to. Freud was right to think the bard was the greatest instinctive psychologist who ever lived. Machiavellians are so much in command of their body language that they can give out very controlled signals. They may appear so convincing because these are precisely the kind of signals we assume to be unconscious and automatic. But Machiavellians use them to give the illusion that they are being sincere when they are really being highly manipulative. For instance, the Machiavellian stares straight at you while lying. Body language starts young. We start to learn body language at birth. We suck, cry, grasp with our hands, and within 4 to 5 weeks, smile. By 6 to 9 months, we point at things. Within 2 years of starting to speak, toddlers learn one human truth. You can say things you don't mean, and not mean things you do say. When they are about 3 years old, toddlers take their first steps in what has to be a lifelong study, the psychology of other people. No one tells toddlers to start being Freud in nappies so they can understand what other people's gestures mean, but unless they are affected either by an autistic disorder or Asperger's syndrome, they do it anyway. By the age of 4, the normal toddler will have learned a good deal about what gestures mean. He or she will also know the differences between reality and pretending. Just to make it easier for children who know the boundary between the real and not real, we often make exaggerated gestures or play faces when we start to pretend. 4-year-olds know that it is not smart to put your hand over your mouth when telling a fib. Under stress, however, even sophisticated adults can forget that. Watch our political leaders the next time they appear on TV to see if you can spot whether they are telling the truth. Where are their hands? The hand, or the fingers, hide the mouth because the mouth is ashamed not to be telling the truth. It is much the same principle when, as a child, we may shush. Argyle, 1975, also made much of the not very elegantly named concept of leaks, which some psychologists, like Peter Collett, 2005, now call tells. The theory again owes something to Freud. In The Psychopathology of Everyday Life, 1930, he gave many examples of parapraxes, as he called them, of people forgetting things or making peculiar mistakes. The unconscious is primitive and teems with taboo desires that tend to erupt. Freud described one woman patient who insisted she was happy in her marriage but kept on fiddling with her wedding ring, taking it off and putting it back on her finger. You didn't have to be a genius to work out she was ambivalent about her husband. Unconscious motives and wishes will get out. Not all of them are as telling or transparent, however, as the wedding ring fidget. The tell started as a term in poker that is now becoming a part of popular culture. In Casino Royale, the first James Bond film to star Daniel Craig, there is much talk of tells when 007 plays poker against the evil Le Chiffre. Bond wins, but he is not that smart of a reader of body language, as he fails to spot that his new girlfriend is actually on the side of the baddies. She is a true Machiavellian. Celebrity, politics, and body language. During the period of rivalry between Gordon Brown and Tony Blair, their body language fascinated the media. In 2004, the Daily Mail asked Peter Collette, the author of The Theory of Tells, to study videotapes of the Chancellor and the Prime Minister, as they were then. However hard the two men tried, their toes and fingers leaked the truth that they were bitter rivals. During Tony Blair's speech at the 2004 party conference, the Chancellor fidgeted a staggering 322 times. This included 15 separate soothing fiddles with his cuffs and numerous glances at the floor, as well as folding his arms and stroking his face, Collett counted. Mr. Blair always betrays his insecurity by stroking his stomach, a sign of seeking a mother's comfort, Collett added. Mothers often rub a baby's tummy to comfort them. Tony's mother is not there to rub his tummy for him, so he does it himself, explained the psycho male. In 2006, things got worse. Gordon Brown was praising Tony Blair when he leaked like a ship in a storm. He touched his nose. Touching the nose, many experts argue, is a displacement activity, which suggests that a person is lying. But the idea that touching the nose shows that someone is lying comes from a fairy tale. In the old story of Pinocchio, his nose grows every time he tells a lie. It has been suggested that a liar touches his nose because blood flow increases when lying. So what seems a nervous tick is in fact a devious tick. The nose toucher is trying to conceal his hooter, which has become engorged and grows redder as the more blood flows into it. Exercise 1.4. Self-observation. One day, jot down every time you touch your nose, and what you were saying or thinking at the time. How often were you lying? Popular interest in body language has had its consequences. When Desmond Morris and Michael Argyle started work in the 1960s, only psychologists had much of a sense of what it was. Today we are all very aware of it, in the developed world at least. We are no longer naive about some of the most obvious signs of body language. That makes it both more complicated and more interesting to understand and to observe. One key concept we need to grasp is that of displacement activity. Displacement activity. Psychologists define a displacement activity as the performance of an act inappropriate for the stimulus that evokes it. When an ostrich is frightened because it sees a leopard is about to pounce, the intelligent thing would be to run. Instead, the ostrich often buries its head in the sand, which does not scare off any predators, but presumably de-stresses the distressed ostrich, for at least a few seconds. Displacement activities usually occur when an animal is torn between two conflicting drives, such as wanting a mate and being frightened because another bird, after the same mate, is bigger and has sharper claws. Some birds facing such a dilemma perch on one leg. Humans go in for displacement activities too, though they don't often bury their heads in the sand or perch on one leg. Chapter 2. The Basics of Body Language. Every spoken language, from the Queen's English to Ganglion Japanese, breaks down into nouns, verbs, adverbs, adjectives, and sentences. Body language also has its basics and grammar. We need to grasp what these are. Mirroring. I want to start this chapter by looking at something many of us sometimes do, either consciously or unconsciously. Recent research has made some surprising discoveries about how and why we mirror. I see you cross your arms, and to show you I am in sympathy with you, I fold my arms too. Sometimes this is called postural echo. Until the late 1970s, psychologists assumed that this ability to mirror was found only in children aged 6 or over, by which time they could be very deliberate. But then someone stumbled onto something extraordinary. In the 1980s, psychologists were amazed to discover that if they stuck their tongues out at a 2-year-old baby, the baby often stuck out his or her tongue back. Newborn babies were supposed to be more bundles of reflexes who could just about suck at the nipple and excrete. The discovery that they could imitate actions flabbergasted scientists. Exercise 2.1. Mirroring in Babies. If you have a newborn baby, or can visit one, stick your tongue out at him or her and see what happens. The conclusion was clear. Newborn babies could pay attention to other people's eyes and faces. 30 years ago, psychologists did not realize how the brain made this possible. The babies didn't know it, of course, but they were using what are now called mirror neurons. They were first discovered, Charles Darwin would be happy to note, in monkeys. Monkey see, monkey do, thanks to mirror neurons. Studies of macaque monkeys have found that they have mirror neurons in their frontal lobes, which are above the eyes. The frontal lobes are involved in planning, among other things. Mirror neurons fire not just when the monkeys perform certain tasks, but also when they watch someone else perform the same tasks. A similar observation and action-matching system exists in humans. When I see you cross your arms, neural circuits that tell me to cross my own arms start firing in my brain. When you see someone who looks angry, hurt, or happy, your mirror neurons activate circuits in the brain for anger, hurt, or happiness. A recent study in Germany by Andreas Hennenlotter, 2005, looked at what the brain does when we smile. He used brain imaging to see what was happening both when subjects smiled and when people smiled at them. The neurons that started to fire when someone smiled at them were much the same neurons that fired when subjects themselves smiled. Enthusiasts claim these neurons help explain how we manage some very surprising skills, including imitation, intuition, empathy, and, according to some, mind reading. Individuals who have sustained damage to their frontal lobes can have many problems with social skills, which depend on such abilities. Exercise 2.2, Self-Observation. One evening at home, whether you are with your partner, friends, or your parents, mirror every position they assume and gesture they make. If they cross their arms, you cross your arms. If they lean forward, you lean forward. Do this for 15 minutes and try to keep count of how many of their gestures you mirror. Then ask if they noticed anything odd about your behavior. The best answer, of course, is that they did not notice anything. If they did, you are mirroring a little too crudely. You want them to feel you are giving them empathic support, but not to realize just how you are doing it. Some of the other basics of body language are facial expression. The human face is hugely expressive. Often, you do not have to say a word for someone to understand you are happy, or sad, or frightened. We are good at recognizing 6 basic emotional expressions: happiness, disgust, sadness, fear, anger, and surprise. Normal children can read the meaning of the look on the face from the age of 4, if not earlier. By the time they are 5 years old, they are quite good fakers. They know how to look happy or sad, even if they don't feel like that, though they tend to exaggerate the expressions a little while learning to deceive. One could argue that children have to learn this. If we were honest all the time, life would be even more stressful. So our faces don't always reveal what we feel. One of the problems children with autism have to cope with is that people find it hard to react to children who always tell the literal truth. Movements of the head. The average human being nods 100 times an hour when they are not alone. To nod consciously is usually to say yes, but the really interesting nods are those that people don't necessarily notice. These signal, for example, that I am listening to you, or that I would like to say something now. There has also been much research on the origin of head shaking, which seems to mean no in nearly every culture. One suggestion is that when babies have had enough of their mother's milk and no longer want to suck at the nipple, they turn their heads away. It's one of the first actions over which the baby has control, and that is how people learn to shake their heads to say no. Angle of the body to others. The way a person positions their body to other people is key. It can be open or closed, welcoming or defensive. It has been argued that there are basically 8 ways the body can be positioned in relation to other people. Exercise 2.3, Self-Observation. What position do you get into when you are sitting with someone you love? How does it change if he or she has said something that really annoys you? Think of the last time you made up with someone. How did your body positions change during the process? One of the nicest ways to position your body in relation to a lover is to spoon round them, or for them to spoon round you. It's no accident that the spoon resembles the fetal position. Many women psychologists point out that men sprawl and just take up more space than women do. A typical male sitting position is with both knees jutting outwards, while women sit more neatly. Hand gestures. Gestures are used in myriad ways, to emphasize something that is sad, or sometimes instead of words. But there are also times when gestures contradict words. For example, if someone says she thinks an employee has just done a good piece of work and taps her fingers on the table, or worse, bites her nails, he should watch his back. These are not usually glowing signs of warmth, and so they suggest she is being insincere in her praise. The position of the palms is also a critical cue. An open, upturned palm suggests vulnerability, and conveys a very different meaning to a palm which faces down, let alone a clenched fist. Arm gestures and positions. Arm gestures are bigger and cruder than hand gestures. Many people feel clumsy because they sometimes just don't know what to do with their arms. One solution is the royal one. Prince Charles often either puts his arms behind his back or sticks his hands in his pockets, which, of course, means he does not have to worry about what to do with his hands or arms. But the pose can also suggest that you have something to hide. We often use our arms to include other people, but we can also use them to reject others. The arm around your shoulder says, "I'm with you," or "I want to protect you." If we cross our arms, however, it is a defensive gesture, a barrier which says, "Do not come near me." Movements of other parts of the body, like knees, ankles, and feet, are under less conscious control than movements of the arms and hands. One sign of this is a classic illustration called the homunculus, which shows how much brain space is devoted to different limbs. Much is devoted to the lips, hands, and fingers, knees, feet, and ankles. We are less aware of people looking at these extremities to judge what they feel. Our knees and feet aren't always conveying profound messages, but they do often indicate how nervous a person is. Leaning forward when sitting and clasping both knees with the hands is a form of self-touching, of seeking for comfort. It also means, "I am about to leave," according to Desmond Morris, the author of The Naked Ape. The following are some very common foot positions people adopt without necessarily being aware of them. 1. The toes are splayed out towards someone else or turned inwards. The first position is essentially an invitation to interact. The second is the opposite, a warning to leave you alone. 2. One foot is wrapped around the other ankle. This position suggests you are anxious and you are touching yourself partly to counter that anxiety. 3. One foot is tapping. This can be a sign of anxiety, but it can also force you to concentrate by building up body tension. Next time you spot someone with his ankle wrapped around the back of his foot, ask him if he remembers when and why he did it. He probably won't. Crossed legs are usually a defensive posture, as are many instances when we touch ourselves. Many of these touches are self-comforting or self-protective. If I am scared, I hug myself. But such gestures can also serve as get-alert signals. People do literally pinch themselves. Medieval monks were given to flagellating themselves as a penance, but it also kept them alert. Gaze and eye contact. The way we look at people is profoundly revealing. Do we stare? Do we look quickly and then look away? How long do we keep looking? Eye gaze has fascinated people throughout the ages. Sumerian clay tablets dating back to 3000 BC tell how Eresh-ki-gal, goddess of the underworld, had the power to kill Inanna, goddess of love, with the eye of death. Less dramatically, in our day, eye contact has been the subject of much research. Social codes of looking. The six muscles that cooperate to move each of our eyeballs are ancient and common to all vertebrates. The nerves of these muscles are linked to the unconscious as well as to the thinking parts of our brain. So our looks may well sometimes say more than we intend. Our gaze behavior, including how long we may look at another person, tends to be regulated by our culture. As a general rule in Western cultures, If you look too little, you may be perceived as shifty or deceitful. If you look too much, you may be perceived as domineering. We tend to feel comfortable if the other person's gaze meets ours for some 60 to 70% of the time. More than that, and we create an impression of an extra special interest. Why else do lovers gaze into each other's eyes? If you make eye contact, for less than a third of the time you are with someone, however, the person you are with is likely to suspect you have something to hide, or that you are dishonest. In some cultures, it is normal for people to indulge in more eye contact than in the West. In Arabia, Latin America, and Southern Europe, all labeled contact cultures, people tend to look more than the British or white Americans. In such contact cultures, too little gaze is seen as insincere, dishonest, or impolite, while in non-contact cultures, too much gaze, staring, can be seen as threatening, disrespectful, and insulting. Staring can be interpreted as a sign of dominance, while looking away or avoiding eye contact may be seen as submissive. This may have evolved from primate behavior, where the unwavering gaze is a dominance ploy. The sociologist Irving Goffman, 1989, described one extreme example of this, the sustained hate stare. Those you stare at for too long usually interpret this not just as deliberate, but an aggressive violation of the normal rules of looking. Continuing from the theme of dominance in looking, or who has the right to look, some researchers describe the colonial gaze, or tourist gaze, which seems to be a detached, potentially proprietary way of looking at something or someone you may want to claim. Jonathan Schroeder of the University of Exeter, 1998, comments that explorers gaze upon newly discovered land as colonial resources. Closing your eyes when you speak, or constantly fluttering the eyelids to give a closed-lid effect, is often disconcerting for those who are listening to you. It seems that you are shutting the listener out from your consciousness, and may also indicate that you are not telling the truth. You may do this out of habit, and are quite likely to be unaware of it. But the impact is very negative. Closing your eyes when you talk to someone is not one of the most sympathetic of eye gestures. At the other end of the scale, attractiveness can be directly related to the size of a person's pupils. Studies have shown that people, especially women, are perceived as more attractive if their pupils are dilated more than normal. In some cultures, belladonna was, and sometimes still is, used to enlarge the pupils. Gaze has been said to convey sexual orientation. Some gay men claim they can recognize each other by a special gaze, described as not only lingering, but also a visual probing, by author Patrick Higgins in his book A Queer Reader, 1993. Psychologists regularly film meetings, the way parents and children behave, and what people do on first dates, to study what eye contact reveals. Video cameras now make it possible to track minutely where people are looking, and sometimes they look at their own body or parts of it. Such self-gaze is quite revealing, especially when these looks are very quick and it is quite often unconscious. The looks are signs of anxiety, as if people are checking that they are actually still there and still exist. The conscious look in the mirror is quite different. Some schools of therapy, like neurolinguistic programming, claim that where someone looks reveals much about what he or she is thinking, a claim I will examine in Chapter 9. Tics and displacements. We are often not aware of what we are doing. I think I am gazing intently at you, but at the same time, I'm also scratching my cheek and checking my tie. Both of these are perfectly acceptable, but they suggest sometimes underlying anxieties. Women often touch their hair and flick it back. Sometimes, we become unable to control particular tics and displacement activities, which can be acutely distressing. And, as I've already mentioned, displacement activities are often the result of stress or ambivalence. I pick at the lint on my suit because I am so excited I need to do something. I want to hold your hand, but I'm afraid I'll be rejected. Case history. A good example of displacement activity was given in an interview with Nico Tinbergen, the Nobel Prize-winning animal behaviorist. Tinbergen told me, "When one of my children began to yawn compulsively, our family doctor said, 'She seems to be very tired,' and I had to explain to him that she was scared stiff. It is a very common displacement activity, such as scratching or biting your nails when under slight stress." Exercise 2.4. Self-observation. What tics do you have? Write down 6 of the things you do when you're anxious. Ask somebody close to you how many of them they notice. Do you want to change them? You can by working out what they are and developing a training routine so that they stop being your normal, unconscious responses. I hope I have made it clear that these basics of body language give rise to a dilemma. How do we know someone means what they are saying to us? Or, to put it more poetically, you're smiling. I wonder if you mean it. I'm as sure as can be you're asking the same question about me. My poem is inspired by a book written by R.D. Laing, a famous psychiatrist of the 1960s and 70s. In Knots, 1970, he explores the tangle of human relationships in such verses, and returned time and again to the big question, how do I know what you are thinking? And the more self-obsessed ones, how do I know what you're thinking about me? Am I revealing things through my body language that I don't want to reveal? If I am revealing anxieties, weaknesses, and secret impulses, what can I do to change the way I leak clues? Leak isn't a very elegant way of putting it, but it is, as we have seen, the jargon psychologists use. The question of what someone thinks about you starts the moment you meet them.